Well, it is a great pleasure this week to meet John Wells. And John, now we've known each other for quite a few years, and we were just discussing before we started that you came to the University of Kent the year after me.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. I think it was September 2005, although I can't remember how we first met.
I reckon it was in the Nero coffee shop, where we often go, and I think it's one of those sort of scenarios where you realise that there's somebody very sort of like-minded in terms of their interest, or maybe somebody had said, John's a real like Nicolas Cage fan or something, and you're like, right, I must meet the legendary John Wills, or John Wick, as I was about to call you, in order to talk movies, and that's what we've done on many occasions over the last decade or so.
Yeah, it's been great to do that with you, and even better to be referenced to John Wick. Don't think I'm quite live up to that standard.
Well, yeah. Well, if you have your own action hero avatar at the end of this interview, I'll do all that I can to make sure that that the myth that is John Wills, you know, can be franchised. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing, because rather excitingly, I think you're actually, we're talking about film just now, but actually, you're a professor currently in history, but you're going to be doing a lot of work, I think, in film from this point on.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. So, I'm actually just moved office and I'm joining media and film at Kent, partly just reflecting that I've worked on those sort of things for quite a few years, and like yourself, been always interested in filmmaking, but also things like video games and broader entertainment too. So yeah, it's an exciting time to do that, and also nice to stay at Kent and keep my friend base too.
Absolutely, yeah. And now actually, when you mentioned video games, I reckon the first time I heard of you was when a mutual friend of ours said, and this may be an apocryphal story, but said, John is really into video games, and he has, and you can confirm or deny the truth of the story, has like a proper like a video, proper old-fashioned video outfit in his house or in his basement or something like that. Like, he's got like all the accoutrements. The equivalent for me would be like of having your own like cinema screening in your own house. So it's like you don't just study video games, you actually live in a video game universe.
Yeah, that's
please tell me that it's true.
To a degree, I think my partner might be a little bit concerned if I had a kind of gaming dungeon or something in the house. But I do have a fair amount of vintage kind of consoles and machines from the 70s onwards that lurk either in my office or at home. But I don't really have a dedicated space yet. I think that could be quite a nice thing to have. And I'm also surprised that you don't have your own personal cinema. I think this is a natural thing to fix in your life.
Well, what you've done, because yes, and one of us was going to have to mention this, that I have seen the latest Mission Impossible film, the Dead Reckoning Part One, a mighty 9 times at the cinema, which equals my record, No Time to Die. Was also 9 times over. And I think you once said to me, especially during lockdown, when the cinemas just started to reopen, and I was regularly posting pictures, I was the only person going to the cinema in Canterbury, if not indeed in the whole of Kent. I was personally responsible for keeping the cinemas afloat. And I think you were like, but Chris, the screen should be named after you. I feel it's the same with you in video games.
that would be delightful. I don't think I've played games a lot, but I'm not sure that I've probably invested quite that degree of my time into them. It should be a kind of aim for me, really. But seeing Mission Impossible 9 times over the last few weeks, I think is quite an achievement. And you should get some sort of personal recognition from Tom Cruise for that.
Well,
I'm not sure how that would work.
No, I should. Well, I could do with his de-aging technology. Because actually, watching it each time, I was watching thinking, because you've seen it, I think, already, haven't you?
I have. I've only seen it once, though, Chris.
Oh, you're starting to catch me up, though. keep going. And what I was finding is the way that he runs in that film, and also just the many close-ups of his face, I was thinking, same with Harrison Ford in the latest Indiana Jones film, I was thinking, this is pretty impressive, because Ford is 81, I think, now, and Tom Cruise is 61. I'm a big fan of the Bond films. I think that I'm sure that's something that we might come on to. And A View to a Kill is, I think, one of Roger Moore's best, but perhaps he was creaking a little bit by the time that was made. I think he was something like 56, 57, maybe 58, maybe around the same age that Cary Grant was in North by Northwest. But you think of Cary Grant, you think of Roger Moore in those films, then you think of Tom Cruise. And it's hard to see Tom Cruise as having aged from the 1990s, and so yes, that, if he was to bequeath me, he can thank me by allowing me to walk around the streets of Canterbury. I don't need the rubber mask that all the characters wear in Mission Impossible, but I could just do whatever digital de-aging technology. If I could wear that around the streets of Canterbury, I'd be a very proud and happy man.
Yeah, I think anybody would be, cause at his age. It's incredible. I think you should be running around Canterbury. That would be.
I would have to run, and he has a very distinctive run as well. So people might think it's Tom Cruise's body double.
That's something to aim for.
There we are. Well, you have to have ambitions in life. That's true. But a serious point about the video games, because it's like with me in film. Because in my case, I got on. I mean, the film passion came quite late for me, because I think it was really at university that I went to a university without a cinema, and that probably made me all the more keen to get into films, because it was more of an effort. If there was a multiplex down the road, maybe I would never have gone, but because I had to travel a bit further to one, it made it all the more sort of, you know, this is what I want to do. So you have to make all the extra effort to do it, and you sort of you know, if something really matters to you, you go the extra mile rather than literally just, you know, saunter down the road. And I was wondering if it's the same kind of with you, because obviously you've made video games, or I say you've made video games your area of interest. It's like the chicken and the egg. Which came first? Did you have a passion for video games, then you did research on it, or did the research lead to this, you know, great passion that you have for playing and engaging, participating in video games?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think that weirdly, or it might not be weirdly, my academic interests have probably been linked to things that I did as a kid. Yeah, in that the three or four things that I've worked on as in my career all reflect almost obsessions or experiences that I had as a young person. So I worked a lot on atomic culture and atomic disasters, and as a kid growing up in the 80s, I was really affected on a deep level by kind of nuclear war scenarios. And then also, as you say about video games, I was part of that gaming generation, or first generation of people who played video games. One of my earliest memories is visiting a fish and chip shop next to where my parents worked, and they had, like, you know, a couple of video games machines there when I was probably, I guess, around five or six years old. And so gaming became part of my growing up. And then also kind of things I've often worked on, things to do with the environment and environmental protest, stuff like that too. Again, kind of I grew up really keen to create a kind of, I guess at that time, like eco-identity. So I was a vegetarian by about 12, 13, partly kind of rebelling, but partly kind of going, yeah, kind of go finding myself, I guess. So in a way, a lot of the things that I've worked on, and also film, like yourself, because I know that you used to catalogue what films you saw and what, and kind of rate them or think about them a lot. As a teenager, I used to do a really similar thing and kind of like rate films and write comments on them. So very much the things that I experienced as a kid somehow became pursuits in my academic career. So in a way, it has shaped it that way round.
It's like a form of apprenticeship, but I suppose with an apprenticeship, you know that that's going to be your chosen career, and you're getting the expertise and the, you know, the experience ready to sort of get paid to do it.
Yeah.
But I mean, I used to write the charts down on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think my parents sometimes, because in those days you didn't have the equivalent of the catch-up or the iPlayer, so you had to catch it live. Or, yes, there was always teletext, but that wasn't really quite the same as hearing the unveiling of the new number one, etc. And I reflect on this, because I think maybe my parents might have been a little bit concerned that, it's just a bit of an obsession. Whatever you do at 5 o'clock on a Sunday, you have to be sitting by the radio and writing all this down. And I think it certainly was an obsession. However, here I am now, all these decades later, and I realise that that was the most wonderful preparation for my career. Because obviously it wasn't a planned thing. I didn't sort of think, yes, I'm going to be writing all these books and theology in the next 40 years or so. But what it meant is, in terms of the way of processing, cataloguing, in those days I'd be using different coloured pens to sort of, you know, note the songs going up or down or non-movers or whatever it might be. But that was kind of a preparation for academic study, because what I'd always be doing is processing material, thinking, this quote would be perfect for chapter three, or there's a great argument here which will counter my chapter one argument, which I'll use in my conclusion. You know, so I've always found it easy, relatively speaking, to assimilate material, and I kind of feel that the seeds of that go back to those passions, and also on another level, it's quite simply that I have this memory of charts and, you know, from yesteryear, which sometimes in a sort of pop quiz or radio quiz type scenario, you suddenly all these bits of information that I'm able to suddenly come by, and you kind of feel, yeah, you know, in that there are in the right time and the right place, you know, at a time when, you know, my own students, my own children are, you know, so much younger, you know, you remember things that are precious to you, but unless somebody is of the same age as you or a bit older, you're aware that increasingly people are like, never heard of it. I know some people who work in television, they're in their 20s, they're very senior in what they do, but they've never heard of teletext. So, yeah. You know, I sort of think, but you know, I grew up with teletext. That was my way before the internet of finding the news. So it sort of somehow matters to preserve this.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was, likewise for me, really formative. I think there's an interesting link there between kind of defining yourself, having your own space, kind of having an emotional attachment to something, but you're also doing it in an intellectual way, or you're kind of creating your own criteria or reflecting on it. There's a kind of coming together there, and I think it is quite powerful and shapes people, or shapes, certainly has shaped myself and you in what we've done in our adult lives. I think as a teenager, I also worked in an independent video store, kind of a version of Blockbusters, which was called Blackadder. I don't know how quite it was called Blackadder without some sort of copyright issue there from the 1980s. But, you know, I can also remember how formative that was, because it was something that I did by myself. And I did it as a young adult. And it also, again, it fitted this kind of interest and kind of it socialized me, but also gave me space to really think about what I enjoy. I think it is intriguing how they can feel like pointless obsessions maybe sometimes by other people, or they at the time you don't recognize the significance, but in retrospect I can really see, yeah, my teenage years, or maybe even younger, really shaping in a positive way now who I am.
And did you find any resistance in I mean, I suppose, I think back to the educational sort of system, you know, when I went to university, and actually I see this as a positive, and my interest in film, for example, hadn't developed at that point. So I did a very almost like pure theology degree, and I loved every minute of it. But then I was able to apply some of my interests to, you know, so I'd got the grounding in my subject, and then was able to do postgraduate work and start specialising. So if, you know, if I did undergraduate or master's work in death in the afterlife, I was able to then look at death in the afterlife in film. So, you know, so there was sort of, you know, so I was drawing on the framework, the theories from my undergraduate work, but then able to bring in the stuff that's bespoke to me. So it kind of all fitted. But when you were doing your undergraduate work, for example, did you find at the time that there were spaces for these sort of interests to be cultivated, or did that all develop subsequently?
Yeah, I actually think that it developed a little bit later. I don't think I actually made the links or really worked myself out until, you know, later in life. I don't think I recognised what was going on with me as a teenager, or even in my 20s, really. I think I went to Warwick University and did a BA there, originally I started an architecture degree at Bath, and I think I just like wandered into different things that I was good at or were kind of safe spaces for me, but I didn't necessarily have a sense of trajectory in my life. And I can remember in my 20s definitely wondering what I wanted to do or what I was really suited to do. Often it's easier to work out what you don't want to do than what you do. And I don't think I'd really worked out my path until probably when I was doing my PhD, and maybe even beyond. So and certainly my talent or my ability to create things of good quality is a fairly recent thing. I think for me anyway, in that my writing has improved considerably over the last 10-15 years. So I don't think when I did my degree, I don't know about when you were doing your degree, but when I was doing that, I don't think I had any specific, you know, real kind of talent there. And also just like when you're younger and doing your first degree, at that time, I think in the mid-90s it was, there was lots of distractions as well, I think, that I kind of went with too.
Yeah, I think in my case, it was that we didn't always have all our essays assessed. And a lot of people were like, well, actually, it's all down to the exams. It will just, you know, just do what we need to do to get by. But I saw all this in important training. And what would then happen is that you'd master something in the course of a week or so. So you'd spend, what I would do is essays would come in every 2 weeks. So I'd spend the first week reading up on whatever the topic was, even like the disestablishment of the church in Wales, you know, not something admittedly that I sort of call on every day. But I thought, I know nothing about this subject. But within the course of a week, I thought, oh, you know, I'm not quite a mini expert, but enough to be able to write a 3,000 word essay, whatever it was. And then I liked that. And then I'd go on to a completely different sort of topic. And so I found that I was able to learn the rudiments of something very quickly just by knowing where to go. You know, exactly, you know, so even now, some of my students might say, if they're doing a dissertation, they say, yeah, but it takes me so long to read a whole book, sort of thing. And I was thinking, yeah, but strategically, we're not asking you to read every book cover to cover. You sometimes just have to know which bits to use. It's just, you know, it's just, you have to kind of know what you're looking for. And then when you found it, you just zoom in and then sort of go to the next source, whatever. So you accumulate lots of pertinent sources, but rather than the idea that you sort of read everything cover to cover and hope that some of it will stick in the memory or whatever. And so there's a lot of trial and error involved. But it's easy, of course, also to retrospectively impose patterns. It's easy to say, you know, it's like being almost like an incipient or an implicit, you know, researcher, where because you started learning those skills early on and now you fine-tuned, as you said, you've harnessed them and you've written good stuff in the last decade or so, it's easy to retrospectively apply that, to imagine that you were already on this journey, and you were already on the journey, but it's easy to impose patterns and structures and almost that sort of idea of, yes, I knew from a young age exactly what I was going to do. And that's often not the case, but actually you can still be on a path to you something without even at the time knowing that end goal exists.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's so kind of intelligent of you. I think that, yeah, we're always trying to make sense of our past and try to work things out. I think that sometimes if you're dealing with crises, life crises or stuff like that, that can seem even more important, where you're trying to work things out, but you're also putting patterns and ordering and maybe sometimes fictionalizing, you know, your past, one's past. I think that's definitely a case with me. And yeah, it's almost confusing sometimes to work out what you were actually like as a teenager. Sometimes I've kind of given myself, probably to some degree, almost like identities, trying to make sense of what I was like when I was young. Some things ring really true, but you know, it's almost like you could do with asking everybody around you what you were like as a teenager. You know, it's quite difficult to make sense of all that.
Yeah, and I find that, and that can actually be quite enhancing, you know, in terms of personal well-being, emancipating even. And I found that through social media because I've reconnected with people and I'm always intrigued to know what they thought of me. You know, I'm aware of what people thought of me at the time, or at least, you know, I'm aware of how I thought of myself. And part of me wants to sort of know what sort of continuum, you know, how have I evolved? How have they evolved? I mean, often, certainly when I was young, some of the what I would perhaps call the idiosyncrasies or the eccentricities, perhaps at the time made you, you know, people would think that's a bit weird, or, you know, Chris is a bit weird sort of thing. But now I think, yeah, I almost wear that with a badge of honour. But I think at the time, anybody who didn't quite fit in, and fitting also often meant being, you know, excellent at cricket or football or something sporty. Yeah. Because that was kind of the thing that mattered. And if you were somebody who wasn't very good at sport or whatever, then, and I did religious studies at A-level and very few of us did that. So there was almost that sense of, I was doing sort of more, it was a church school, but I was doing more minority kind of things. Yeah. I wasn't the most mainstream of people. And yet I've used all that to my advantage. So the interests that I've cultivated over the years, you know, are distinctive rather than just doing what, you know, perhaps seemed like the right sort of thing to do in terms of fitting in. Fitting in might be something you want to do at 14, 15, but when you're sort of at 50, sometimes you want to stand out. So I found that the things that maybe I was a bit embarrassed about, or the things where I was aware that people might, you know, sort of think, gosh, you know, Chris is funny, Chris is weird. You know, now I feel that being a bit more sort of true to myself, whatever that means, is perhaps more important than sort of doing, conforming to somebody else's paradigm.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly perceptive. I think that for me too, I wasn't good at sport when I was a teenager. I didn't really kind of fit in brilliantly. I was the sort of person that was known for being quiet and being very academic. I had a few close friends, which weirdly they're still close friends of mine at that time, and I think there was a sense of not fitting in, and I had that draw of partly I didn't want to fit in, and there was almost a difficulty there, I think, within me, whereby I didn't want to fit in, but I also could feel kind of somehow not okay with myself. And I think over time I've actually realised that I don't, you know, I'm quite happy not fitting in with things, and I'm quite happy being, having my own kind of distinctive pursuits. But it's strange. Yeah, for me, being a teenager, I found quite difficult, especially in retrospect. And I recognise that I had periods of depression going on there, definitely as a teenager. And it probably wasn't necessarily helped by listening to The Cure and The Smiths and things like that excessively. nor my penchant for wearing black and getting told off once or twice from school. And that's probably the only times I was ever told off at school. Yeah, I think there's a... Yeah, I don't remember, but I do have nice memories, and sometimes they were nice memories were actually being in my own space. I can remember focusing on, I did more unusual A-levels, and one of them I did a kind of design A-level, and I was the only student in the school who did the design A-level. And yeah, I can remember almost like blissful times just working by myself on design projects, things like that. But yeah, I can feel there's definitely senses of isolation and difference going on there too. Yeah,
and I wonder, especially in the light of, you know, what might happen with one of their own children, that some of those things that now can be labelled, you mentioned depression, but yeah. I'm betting that when you were young there was no sort of diagnosis as such, or at least easy now to look back and think that's probably what you had, but at the time it must have been even harder, because you probably wouldn't have had the sort of support networks in place that thankfully and hopefully are much more sort of available in the present day.
Yeah, totally. I think in the 1980s, there wasn't, as far as I knew anyway, really conversations in that way over depression or support over it. I think it was often a kind of hidden challenge. I think it would be useful. Yeah, it would have been useful for many people to try to understand what that depression was about. I think you know, my adulthood, I've learned to, I think, live with depression at times, but I've also learned some kind of joys and skills from those experiences. You know, I think it helped lead me to be a Buddhist. It also helped lead me to really get in touch with exercise and to do lots of exercise. When I'd rejected it as a teenager, I became weirdly quite addicted to it as an adult. I think, you know, that I've realized that there's beauty also from things like depression, in that you can learn to have a full kind of emotional bandwidth. Yeah. And you can emotionally really engage with life. So I think in a way it would have been useful to know some of those things as a teenager, or realize that, for example, doing exercise might help you, or medication might help you, stuff like that. So it was a kind of hidden aspect, yeah. And it wasn't something that was talked about.
Yeah. And are you in touch with anybody from that era? Because that for me is the crucial thing, because it's trying to make sense of sometimes, you know, a period in your life when, I think you're right, you go through something horrible, but what it does is make you all the more perhaps self-aware, maybe in some ways more empathetic. You sort of go through something that's really not very pleasant, but in coming out of it, or at least being able to process it and harness it, then in a way you probably have a much greater skill set, because you say, okay, what was that all about? And what happens if it comes back? Or, you know, what happens if, do I live with this forever? Was it a one-off? Was it just a teenage thing? Or is it a life thing? And the perceptions of people who may or may not have understood that, and who perhaps themselves have, either directly or maybe through their own children, similar experiences. I always wonder what is the equivalent of, like, the bullies in school. You know, I remember people at school who weren't very nice, but I think, do they ever look back on those days and think, oh yeah, maybe that wasn't a very nice thing to do? Or do they block it out? What happens if their own children, you know, does the cycle perpetuate? So I'm going back a lot in terms of trying to work out exactly where you go with all of that. How do you deal with some of those difficulties? And do you do it on your own? Do you try and reconnect with people? Do you try and find some form of hope or catharsis?
Yeah, that's. I think with me, I haven't really talked about it. I've got a couple of friends from secondary school here. One of them probably I'm in touch with pretty much daily, and the other one fairly regularly. And it's strange because we haven't revisited though some elements of those experiences. You know, maybe they also had. I think they also had kind of similar challenges at times. That's probably why we got on so well. But it's interesting for me. I think I've worked on myself as quite a more of a counselling or private thing, or working it out as an independent thing, maybe too. But yeah, it's actually, you've made me think about chatting with them more about that time spent. It's said often our conversations are now kind of in the now, in that they're quite presentist and they're quite what we're up to. It's intriguing, actually. We haven't really nostalgized or really talked about our pasts that much, which is quite a normal thing to do. If you spent I've known one of my best friends, Tim, for around about 40, 42 years. So it's actually quite a sizable chunk of time.
But there were different pathways, because I think my problem was this, perhaps it was this need to fit in, or to fit in terms that I couldn't do based on other people's criteria, other people's paradigms. Obviously, I'm using language now that I wouldn't have used at the time. I wouldn't have said, what's your paradigm? what's the dynamic that I need to change? But what would happen is that you would almost accept the narrative that you're a bit weird. But there are passions that I had and still have. And one thing I have learned from talking to people from that sort of era is that I think generally that sense that I always seem to be a kind of, not so much happy person, but I'm a very you know, I'd always be receptive. I enjoyed people's company. So maybe as somebody labelled me a year ago or so as maybe like a socially awkward extrovert, you know, an introverted extrovert. And I think that's probably right. There was always that need to disseminate, to project myself, to perform. And yet you want to perform, but if you do it in the wrong place, then you're going to make an idiot of yourself. But if you make an idiot of yourself, then actually that can give you the tools to, you know, to maybe ensure, okay, but I still want to perform. It hasn't stopped me wanting to perform. It just made me realise that this is the wrong venue in which to do it. So that can sort of make you sort of try and work out other strategies. But it is interesting, isn't it, the way that we're not aware of the patterns at the time, but those friendships that endure, sometimes the resilience maybe that comes with trying to work it through, trying to say, you know, there's a joke there about Robert Smith being not the problem but the cure, you know. Uh-huh. Robert Smith is the cure, but there is something about the way that maybe we do things back to front, that you listen to all this dark music and wearing black, but actually that probably was literally the cure in a way, because that was your way of dealing with it. You know, it's sort of you need to go into a dark place in order to find that sort of comfort, because if you sort of follow everybody else's paradigm, as you know, I know a few people who said that they only like to watch like Disney type movies, but if you've just watched Disney type movies, then that can be great, but sometimes we all need a counterpoint. And without that counterpoint, sometimes then you don't always know how to deal with particular difficulties. You need to have somewhere to go that allows you to explore some of those facets that may not be available in more everyday kind of discourse.
Yeah, that's really true. I hadn't really thought about it in that way. I think that for me, it's been that sense of safe space or me, and certainly. You know, I think over the last 5 or 10 years, I think that I've returned to some of those elements because that I enjoy them more. And my wardrobe, apart from the fact that I'm wearing a blue top today, it's as my partner's pointed out, there's a very limited colour range in the wardrobe. And likewise, with music and you know, an unhealthy addiction to watching horror films and things like that. There are things that I think I actually in my 20s or early 30s I pushed to one side, whereas now I've recognised that actually they're part of me, or they're things that I enjoy, and they reconnect me to my youth. But actually I think there's a comfort now with my youth and myself, and they're kind of just they're things that I follow or enjoy.
And it would be good to talk about about those films, because remind me where you grew up.
So I grew up in Leamington Spa initially, which is in Warwickshire, and then my parents, when I was probably about 11, they moved to a comprehensive on the edge of Birmingham. So and then I lived in Bristol, so there's probably a few, my accent probably has a bit of a problem with it because I've moved through different regional
although Nicolas Cage, whose name will probably come up more than once, I think has a home or had a home in Bath.
Oh wow.
Apparently there was some bizarre thing a few years ago when he switched on the Christmas light, so he was asked, but he was a local resident, and of course he was doing his usual sort of over the top performance, the caricature of Nicolas Cage, and he was switching on the lights, and he was going, "It's a great pleasure here in Bath and Avon," you know, sort of giving the whole county name. It's like nobody there would actually call it Bath and Avon, you know. Bath would be, and it would be fine. But I think we connected through a lot of those passions for some of the same type of films. We'd often we have been to the cinema together to watch often horror, actually Halloween, and we saw one of the It films. I think it was the sequel, but film is something that probably, I'm guessing that you perhaps grew up with film a bit earlier than I did.
Yeah, I think, well, I don't know how early yourself, but yeah, I used to, my parents actually were really good at going to the cinema, and so I saw films pretty young at the cinema. I can remember seeing, I think it was 1975 or 76, so I was only about 4 or 5, I saw Benji, which is probably not the most groundbreaking movie. I think it's a Disney style story about a dog, a talking dog, I think, from memory. And then I can remember seeing the first Star Wars they took me to in 77, and the Black Hole, and early Bond movies as well. I saw, when I was still in single digits. So I think in a way, without my parents weren't into film, but they took me to the cinema. And then, yeah, as a teenager, I watched an awful lot of film through the video store, through working at a video store, through just being by myself. I think I used to watch a lot of film, and also it would be sometimes on in the background while I do kind of art or design or stuff like that at home. Yeah, so it's always been kind of quite strong in my life. I don't think I have the same knowledge level of yourself, but it's certainly been a real kind of, yeah, a place where I feel safe too. I think when if I go to the cinema or I watch a film, I can feel very much part of that landscape, part of that world, and yeah, it has a comfort for me.
And what you said about going on your own,
Yeah.
I think is very important, because I'm very often at the cinema, indeed even this very week, when there's nothing worse than seeing the groups coming in. We've talked about the Creed movies, and I
Yeah.
think we both had we haven't seen the Creed movies together, but we both had similar experiences in different cinemas in different towns, where groups of young men or whatever have gone in as a group, and there's been a bit of a vibe. And I think, actually, didn't you say there was actually a fight that broke out in the
Yeah.
Ashford cinema?
It was an amazing experience in retrospect, in the lead up to, I think it was Creed 1 or 2, two guys in the audience decided to actually have a fight just beneath the screen. It was almost as though it had been set up there, or it's like a special kind of trailer or lead in to Creed. Their skills weren't quite on a kind of boxing or international boxing level. But it was really amusing. But yeah, no, I haven't had that experience recently. Although I don't think the same audience probably. I think the last film I saw was Barbie, so I don't think you'd probably get quite the same men fighting in the front in the lead up to that movie.
Well, if they felt that they were disenfranchised Kens,
But they
they
probably
would
would
have
have
gone.
left for this in the cinema anyway, actually, in disgust.
But it is funny how we identify. Actually, the Barbie film is a funny one, because it has really appealed to almost every demographic. And I mean, horror is something that really obviously is your kind of thing. And can you remember things like you mentioned Benji, but are there particular films that really mattered when you were growing up, with the sort of ones that maybe even today you still think about and talk about? Are there films that you thought, when you mentioned Star Wars, but anything that really sort of moulded you?
Yeah, that's a good question, and one that I probably, yeah, could do with thinking about in a longer period. But I think that certain movies that were dystopian and apocalyptic, I mean, they fitted the time period, and they probably fitted some of the kind of darker senses within me or fears within me. But yeah, movies like Logan's Run from the mid-70s, I found that really intriguing, and I think it appealed to me because it had this dark future, but it had almost this romantic and optimistic kind of survival narrative whereby, the couple survives and lives and comes out into a kind of bucolic wilderness at the end. And so it had a kind of positive element to it, but it was also very dark and dystopian. I think Logan's Run is a great example of a movie that I was fascinated with as a kid. I did watch a lot of horror, and my parents were quite liberal over that. I'm not quite sure why, but I ended up watching a huge amount of horror when I was young, and probably the 18 certificate was bypassed. So I can remember watching Alien, as a very young teenager, which was again a very powerful and strong movie, I think, to watch at that time. Yeah, and also start. I grew up. This is not horror, but I grew up with like Star Trek the original series on replay, so I can remember some of my earliest memories of TV and watching stuff. I my parents owned a newsagent and worked there very diligently, and I was put in the back room with a black and white a little television, and I think I watched the original series of Star Trek over and over and over on repeat, which I think I've now owned Star Trek as my own and kind of love that. Whereas there was a time where that was probably quite embarrassed, or it's quite an awkward thing to like. But yeah, I think it was really, really kind of, lots of things really. And yeah, I love, like yourself, I love watching film, now.
But I think when you have those sort of opportunities, I'm somebody who has a problem with violence in the real world. In other words, I would literally cross the road to avoid, if I thought of an aggression, I'd be like, oh no, stay away from that space. I'm very wary of and very uncomfortable with aggression in any form. But I will happily watch it at the cinema. And I think it's the counterpoint argument. I think that, if I'm somebody who would have a real problem with tension, fighting, aggression, it's interesting that I teach on violence in film. And I'm sure that's not coincidental. So, one of the first films, the films that made a real impact, I was 17, and I went to university in West Wales, and it was so far away from anywhere. Mm. They had to put us over. We went to a new entrance conference, so we had to stay a couple of nights because you couldn't just do it for the day. And so they put a film on for us, the Students' Union. Looking back, we were all 17, and they showed us Taxi Driver. Retrospectively, that was a curious choice, but it's one that had made such a... Because I watched this film, was so completely intoxicated. I didn't understand a word of it, but it was the very paradox of it that worked. The whole... The prostitute and the politician or the pimp and the sort of, who's he going to kill? And he wants to destroy in order to save. And, he dies in order to be kind of, to be the saviour, the hero. He's a destroyer, but also a hero. He's a redeemer who wants to get rid of all the squalor on the street. So there were lots of things going at once, and taking a date to a pornographic movie, and everything there just made no sense at all. But I was so completely spellbound by this, and confused and frightened, but also more than anything else, there was an allure here. It was almost like it was a pathway to a different world, a world that was so different from my own experience. And I'm sure that the fact that I studied Taxi Driver as one of the primary texts, I shouldn't call it text, should I? A film for my PhD owes to that experience. So that sort of notion of counterpoint, and in your case, you mentioned you're a Buddhist. I don't see you as a very aggressive figure, but you watch horror films.
I'm very conflict averse. I feel very uncomfortable. Either conflict. In an emotional way, and also as a Buddhist, I think things can be a lot more positive between people, and it's quite intriguing that I also should say that I go to watch all these horror films with a friend who's also a Buddhist. Yeah. So basically you've got a situation whereby our social life together is based around watching horror, which is a bit odd really. I think for me, they are very, I'm very violence averse, but I think that there's a sense of, I'm quite intrigued by the darkness of them. I think there's that element within me of horror. I think that I'm also, I find them, there's a kind of, there's an adrenaline or there's a fear element to them. I like also how some of them are really kind of original, or they make me think about deeper things actually. And they also tackle death, and we tend to avoid death. In society, we tend to imagine it's not real. And I think horror, though obviously, in not a good way, but it tackles those senses of what is meaning, what is death. And they have, I think they're quite powerful. Sometimes a good horror, not, you know, can be quite a powerful experience. So I watched Talk to Me a few days ago, and yeah, I found that it's quite intense. Yeah. I quite like an intense experience sometimes.
Yes, yeah. I saw that twice. Don't worry, I'm not going to. I won't hit nine. But the first time, I didn't know I was going to be watching it. It was one of those secret screenings, you know. Sometimes,
yeah.
And so I had no idea what I was going to watch. And I actually, you'd be surprised. You might think that I'd love the chance to be what, you know, watching. I don't know what I'm going to watch. I go to the cinema all the time. But actually, if I know what I'm going to watch, whether it's the first time or the ninth time, then in some way I know how long it's going to be. I kind of know what sort of experience I'm going to be in for, so I can acclimatise. You know, you need to mentally sort of get yourself ready. What I found in that occasion is that, obviously, I had no idea what it was. Ironically, I had just literally, while I was sitting in the audience, booked my ticket to see it because it came out on the Friday. So I saw it on the Monday night and it came out on the Friday. And I just booked my seat thinking, you know, because the cinema times are released on the Monday. So I just booked it. And then I thought, then it was shown. And I thought, oh, right, maybe I shouldn't have booked it quite so quickly. But this is an interesting observation. As soon as people saw that it was a horror film, because, you know, the brothers who directed it said, hey, this is The Secret Screening tonight and this is our new horror film, people just got up. Quite a few people left. A few people got out at that point. A few people got out after the first scene, which is enough. And a few people maybe gave it another 20 minutes, half an hour. So within the last half hour, it was pretty obvious that the people who were left were those who were able to stomach all of this. But maybe there's some sort of inner sort of sociologist in me. But I was so distracted or aware of the time, you know, people getting up, walking out, fidgeting. I couldn't focus on the film, and I had to watch it again. So I'm glad I did book it for the Friday, for that reason. Because I have mixed feelings about that. Because part of me thinks that if you're gonna, you know, if you're averse to horror, then to sit through it just because it's sort of socially almost because you know you got your ticket kind of thing, is wrong. But also, if you're watching in a communal space and people are like, "Well, I'm not going to watch this. I'm going to walk out," then actually that becomes impossible to dissociate from the film because you're watching. Because normally when I watch a film, people don't walk out for obvious reasons because they paid that money and they know what they're going to, broadly speaking, they know what they're in for. So I find it interesting how people will react in a very different sort of way to the way that I would react. But like yourself, you know, I will very happily watch a horror film. And yet, in a way, it is the polar opposite of perhaps how I would identify myself. In other words, the whole the darkness, the horror, the demonic. I study all these things. I teach on those things. But in a way, it's not reflective of my character. So it's interesting that I watch those sort of things. But I'm the person who will stay to the end. I would never walk out. So it's interesting what you learn about yourself, because you've got the people who walk out and the other people who will stay, because you perhaps I see films as a form of education as well as entertainment.
I don't think I was trying to remember anything that I've walked out of. I don't tend to with film. I think maybe in the mid 80s I might have. I'm not sure this is a good thing to admit to you. I might have walked out of Cocktail, but you might discommunicate me or something, or reject me as a friend saying that it's a Tom Cruise movie. that might be the only thing I've walked out of. I think also I guess we have periods. People have periods of adjusting to film, don't they? And like you said, you know, I've probably watched so much horror that I don't always notice how disturbing it can be, maybe. Whereas if you're sitting there expecting a family film, you would be very shocked to be watching Talk to Me, because that's quite a harsh jump.
Well, I do have a story, but before we have a few sort of more wrapping up questions, but I have a story to convey back in, would have been in 1998, when I went to see I think it was Deconstructing Harry, a Woody Allen film.
Yeah,
and it was showing at a cinema in Cardiff. And it was only showing, like, on the Wednesday. It was like a one-off screening at, you know, 6 or 7 in the evening. And there'd been some mistake at the box office, because they had obviously got the performances mixed up, all the screens mixed up. And they were selling tickets for Dr. Dolittle, the Eddie Murphy version.
Okay.
And I was aware that there were some children, you know, I heard the person saying, you know, you're in screen six or whatever. And there were children in front of me. And I thought a Woody Allen film, Deconflicting Harry, is probably not, you know, the sort of film where people will go, but their families, it, you know, everything. So I kind of knew what was going to happen, but I thought, I don't work here. You know, I'm just the punter kind of thing. But anyway, so the film started. It was indeed Deconstructing Harry. So I was in the right place. And there was, without, I obviously won't repeat what will happen, but there's a scene where it references Bill Clinton and some of the, one of the reasons why at the time, because we talk about impeachment in relation to other presidents, but certain things that he may have done or alleged to have done in the sanctuary of the White House. And this was all referenced in a monologue at the beginning. And of course, you're aware then that all these parents who brought their innocent offspring and were watching what was effectively a very adult, in terms of its themes, movie. So of course, they all had to leave. So all these families were walking out in disgust of a Woody Allen film. Perhaps on some level, Woody Allen might have, might have enjoyed that incongruity.
Yeah, it reminds me also of my son Jude, who's seven. He saw a picture, I'm not sure whether it's on TV or a magazine, of a Woody Allen film. Mm. And his response was, is that you, Daddy, in that picture? So I'm slightly disturbed that Jude now thinks that Woody Allen on many levels. Yeah. although obviously, you know, he's a genius too. I think it's a whole new ball game taking kids to the cinema and what content's right. And Sam and I took, and my partner Sam and Jude, we went to see Barbie actually, and I was slightly wary whether Jude would kind of get it or enjoy it, but he absolutely adored the movie, which was really fun and really great. And he was also concerned massively over both Barbie and Ken, that they would be okay, and that Ken would feel all right about himself, so, and that the Barbie had kind of a role in life. So he took away some great kind of messaging from that film, as well as like loving Ryan Gosling in it, which I shared a lot. So it was good. You know, sometimes adult films that have an adult quality to them, you know, can be great for kids if it's done in the right way.
Absolutely. And that really hit the mark. And it was actually a very sort of adult film that it reminded me of, was the, you know, the David Bowie, Nick Rogue, The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yeah.
Of, you know, coming from another world.
Yeah, definitely.
And then being tainted, compromised, corrupted by this world.
Yeah.
Which is exactly the dynamic in the Barbie world. You've got, you know, Barbie and the real world. You've got the two different domains and how they intersect with each other. So it was very funny to, and Splash, I suppose, which I haven't seen in years, with, you know, Tom Hanks and Daryl Hannah. But there's those notions there of the two. The I suppose the Little Mermaid is the same, but, you know, the mer world and the, you know, the earth world, the man world kind of thing. And seeing how they, you know, very sort of patriarchal based there, and how they intersect. So I got all of that. For me, the Barbie film was I remember, I think it was the Variety review, I said it was more of an intellectual than an emotional experience. And so for me, because I watch ridiculous numbers of films, as has already been attested, but so, but interestingly, with that and Oppenheimer, which are the films that like everybody was going to see, somehow, and maybe it's because everyone else was going to see them, I was a little more underwhelmed, which is perhaps surprising, because, you know, I watch everything, but the film that everyone is watching, I was a bit like, I'm not so sure. But I'd be going to watch those films that actually kind of, you know, fell off the radar a little bit, and I'd be happy to go and watch those multiple times if they're still showing, of course, after a week, rather than the obvious one. So there's almost a part of me again, like the counterpoint thing, is that I kind of want to go my own way.
I totally get that, and it's been really intriguing how marketing and word of mouth can make a picture so big, and how we all kind of react to that, don't we? Because on many levels that could have been quite a smaller movie or less successful. I really liked it. But I think that Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie were great anyway, so La La Land is one of my favourites. So you can probably see a kind of Gosling thing on here. I love that. But yeah, it's intriguing, what, because a lot of people probably went to that film and found it quite disappointing or not what they were expecting. Whereas, yeah, it was actually kind of surpassed for me. Yeah. But yeah, and my partner watched it again last night. Sam did actually, and she was wearing pink, I think. So.
Yes, I think I joked on Facebook that because I was there in my pink outfit.
Well, yeah, you should embrace.
Although I may have worn my pink Barbie shoes and then sneaked into Mission Impossible in 4DX. That's right. That's what really happened. But just a couple more questions. I mean, what would your younger self have thought about what you're doing now? I mean, we were talking earlier about imposing or, you know, retrospective kind of trajectories or sort of imagining things. But what do you think your younger self, like your son's age, would think about what you're doing now?
Yeah, that's a really deep question, isn't it? I think that actually, I don't think my younger self would probably believe what I do. I think that my younger self probably lacked a lot of confidence and was even though I was academically really gifted, you know, when I was young, I don't think I really had ambition, and I don't think I really had a sense of what I could achieve. So in a way, I think my younger self would be very shocked, actually, what I've done. And also, you know, I think my younger self hadn't really thought naturally about some of the wonderful experiences you can have in life. And, you know, having Jude is like the most beautiful thing in the world. And I don't think my younger self would have ever have thought like having a child can change you so much. Yeah. So I think in that way, but I can also see a lot of continuity there as well. So I don't think I'm on that way. I probably haven't fully outgrown that childhood or that child self either.
Did you ever keep a diary?
Yeah, I did. Not to the scale that know that you did.
You don't have to feel defensive about that. I am a law unto myself.
No, I did. I did, though. Yeah, I did keep diaries for stuff, but they've long gone. My parents kind of once I left for uni, they kind of detoxified or got rid of stuff, and I probably did as well. So I haven't got those kind of reference points that you have.
Well, that's what, yeah, because what I did a few years ago, I did go back over all those old diaries, and I say digitized them, but I literally sort of wrote them all up on the computer, which is not the same as actually, but you know, putting them through a machine that actually wrote it all up. But the experience was interesting to see almost the same sort of style of writing almost that you see you can see, and often the things I'd write would be absurd, like for example, you know, when I was 9, it would be all about the stuff I'd watch on TV that day, and it would be like saw Top of the Pops. Mike Reed was the presenter. Then I'd draw a picture of Mike Reed, awesome. You know, like a stick and set. And then I'd list all the artists who were on it, you know. So love I look it. Back now and it's kind of funny, but I think, yeah, I should readopt the pictures, you know, to
I'm loving
what I'm doing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there's definitely continuity there. But it was surprising, you know, just how similar it was in terms of the way that I saw the world.
But also creative as well. I really like that creativity that you're kind of providing. Like visual elements to this. Yeah. I don't think in my diaries I did that, but I did do a lot of art, but I kind of kept them separate. Yeah. But that is super cool.
And I got one final question, the one I always finish my interviews with, which is, would you consider yourself, John, to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I actually have a bit of discomfort looking back, and I talked about this with my partner as well, in that I'm a sort of person that doesn't tend to revisit much where I've lived. I tend to not kind of... I have a slight discomfort or sadness sometimes in revisiting the past. So I tend to try to live in the moment. That sounds very Buddhist and very idealistic, really. But I do as much as I can to feel now, like the qualities of the present, and not get too kind of caught up in either direction. That's the ideal for me. And I feel the beauty or the memories can sometimes come from us really connecting with the now and kind of really acknowledging what you do. One of the most beautiful memories I have is during lockdown, Jude and I used to go for walks, lots and lots. And I can really vividly remember like taking him for one walk when he was very young and kind of, it sounds bad, shaking him, or we were kind of on a big hill near where we live, and just like chatting and I was spending time with him. I think afterwards he did need a wee out in public, but it was, I can remember at the time thinking, oh, this is a special moment, or I really need to concentrate on this. And through like being in the now, I've got like, yeah, some like beautiful memories now. But yeah, generally just being, trying to be with the moment is what
it's. Oh, that's such an amazingly considered, you know, reflective answer. But yeah. John, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure. Sorry I haven't done it before, but lovely to see you always, Chris. Great friend. Thank you.